This is James Hillman. This was in April 25th, 1989. The right to remain silent.
And when talking with Dr. Levy about it, it took a while to consider what subject, what topic, what way I wanted to talk. And my concern nowadays is much more with the problems of therapy rather than what's good about it. Sort of we all know what's good about it. But there are a lot of other things that are giving us trouble in the world, and one of them is the political world. And I wanted to make some kind of connection between, or I have been the last few years, thinking more about the relation between democracy and therapy, between politics and art, between the problems outside of the consulting room, because the soul doesn't exist only inside the consulting room and only inside our skins. So what I want to bring this evening seems to me, still that hissing, what I wanted to bring this evening is partly because my imagination of Seattle is that people here have a political interest. That they're, you know, after all, you did manage to vote for Dukakis as well as Robertson, but still you do have a kind of political interest. So it seemed maybe this would... And then this is also addressed to people who work with children, who work in the arts, in art therapy in particular. So it is something I wrote recently for art therapists, for a convention of art therapists who are not Jungians, in order to talk about Jungian psychology in a way that they might be able to understand it without the usual language of Jungian psychology on which Jungians depend for communication. There might be ways of talking about it where we don't need to use our usual language. So I hope that if I don't use much Jungian language, you'll still be with me. So let me note at the beginning two key assumptions. And the first is that I assume that as a member of the helping professions, you most likely do therapeutic work with children, many of you, or younger people. And when I use the term therapeutic, I use it to cover a very wide field of the helping professions. And second, when I talk about children at all, or younger people, I don't mean only those whom we meet in schools or clinics or offices. I mean as well the inner child. And the child and the teenager within that unreconstructed and hyperactive and hyperfantastic and overachieving younger person, sometimes a bit retarded as well, or left back, who we carry around with us wherever we go, and who gives us so much trouble that when anybody asks you, "How are you?" you say, "I'm okay, hey, no problem." Because of that little guy who's gives you so much problems. And the figure is part of us to whom we refer when we say of ourselves or someone says of us that we are immature, childish, undeveloped, infantile, autoerotic, narcissistic, or just a big baby. That's still that piece. And this big baby who appears in our moods and demands and walks around in our dreams in the guises of children we knew from early school years keeps us in therapy with ourselves. And we are in the helping profession, those of us who are in it, partly because we are working in behalf of the needy and disturbed behavior of children out there, but also partly because we are working in behalf of the needy and disturbed childish behavior in here, because we still walk around like big babies in part. So we're all therapists and all cases, each of us, in that we are all working on ourselves much of the time. So you see, I'm speaking as much about something as I am addressing something in you from something in me. This style of proceeding is what I mean by psychological talk, because that's what we're doing tonight, is a psychological talk. The subjective element is never too far out of sight. You can never get out of the psyche. That's one of Jung's basic ideas. Whatever we say about something says something about us. You're never objective. You're always talking somewhere or another about yourself. Is it better?
What happened?
He turned it off. Thank you. The basic... Oh, no! The basic metaphor for the therapeutic work to be explored here is taken from the law. You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you. And the fuller statement of this warning is shorthandedly called Miranda from a Supreme Court decision. The man is trying to signal something to me. Okay. You have the right to remain silent. What a laugh that is, in fact, regarding children. If only they would remain silent and sit still. Zooming around the room like propelled missiles or 18-wheel trailer trucks, lying, popping off, hyper, incessant, or they abuse the right by closing off, monosyllabic, sullen. A woman whose art therapy I supervised for a while calmed the bedlam and focused attention of about 15 children. They were about 4 to 7 little children. By telling them a story, they got drawn into the story. At the end of the tale, she asked them each to draw the story. Mostly they did a figure from it. The duck, the house, the little girl under a tree. Then she asked them to make another drawing of the story. The second one usually turned out to be less an illustration of a figure directly linked with the story and more a descent into the mood and the theme that freed the fantasy to go further. Now, there are two or three useful things to see from this very simple example. That first, she calmed them down by telling a story. Second, that she asked them to draw the story. And then she asked them to draw it a second time. First, her telling a story draws children into silence. This kind of silence produces a quality of attention different from disciplinary silence. Disciplinary silence is repressive, of course. Hence the squirming at the edge of giggling and rebellion, or the vacuity of not listening when you're told to sit still and listen, when you go right off and stop listening. Second, the example shows that imagination deepens in silence. The drawings went from illustrations still attached to the outer referent, the story with the duck, the house, and the little girl under the tree, to what is not spoken and not here. In contemporary terms, the imagination moved from presence to absence. Imagination tends to go to what is not there. Imagination tends to go to what is not there. That's why we call making visible what is not there creative expression. Now notice in my account the curious play on the word draw. The children were drawn into silence by the story, and as the story was drawn out in its details, they made drawings of it and from it. The imagination draws. It drags attention along with it, and it draws, sketches, or configurates outlined images. To put this another way, I'm going to stop a minute, try to get the sound better. Can you make the sound less hissy or something? We had it better for a minute, didn't we?
Yeah.
Because I can imagine it disturbs me, isn't it? Maybe lower it somehow. I'm talking about drawing, that imagination drags attention along with it and it draws, sketches, or configurates outlined images. To put this another way, imagination shapes itself by means of images, and these images draw and hold attention. They concentrate thoughts and feelings. See, the room got concentrated. These little kids got concentrated. Suspending action. One of the things an image is supposed to do is arrest movement. Whether it requires silence for this drawing to take place, or whether silence results from this drawn into itself, or withdrawn concentration of the psyche in the midst of images, there is some important, necessary, and curious relation between silence and the drawing power of imagination. I tend to feel that this silence is an animal silence, like a watching cat or a pointing dog or a still lizard on a wall. There seems to be a phylogenetic level of the soul, an animal being that connects with actual animals in silence, and especially gets on well with the childish piece of the psyche. I'm making connection there between the child and the animal, which is somehow happens anyway with children. I tend to think that this animal being, which is very old and not at all stupid, is to what therapy must appeal and with which it must connect for therapy to take place. And this connection requires the silence of an animal noticing. The notions of therapeutic trust, empathy, security, and support seem to me to refer to and rest upon a more basic animal silence. So the question then becomes, how do we speak without using what we say against the silence? Because it isn't enough just to have the silence, evidently. At least therapists think they've got to say something. So this phrase, whatever you say can and will be used against you, of course, refers to the present use to interpretations. We tend to use what people say to us against them in some curious way or against someone else. An abusing parent, a probation officer, an anonymous bureaucrat, the idealization of youth and growth often evokes a counter tendency. We idealize youth and growth, and then there's a counter tendency to put it down. We want to be realistic, to grind down and rub a nose in the dirt. Now, we may not do this down-putting directly. We may do it indirectly with reductive explanations, especially sexual explanations. What's really going on in this case is the result of sexual abuse, sexual fantasy, psychosexual maturation, sexual inferiority, sexual obsession, seduction, jealousy, or a lack of sexual identity, and so on. Now, these sexual interpretations of problems are no more real than any other interpretations. They seem more realistic only because they provide an earthy, maybe dirty, polar counterpart to the idealizations that we have about youth and children. Similarly, sentimental idealizations of an innocent, asexual childhood provide another counterpart to sexuality and deny the child his or her own authentic early sexuality. You're familiar with this, I'm sure. Moreover, sexual interpretations tend to make us counselors and therapists and so on feel wiser and more experienced than our young clients, thereby weakening their power to imagine their own experiences. See, we know more about it than they do. So they either are left unable to imagine further their own experiences because we know more about it. But there are other effective interpretations that result in using interpretations against the client. For instance, something happens and then one says, "You must hate your father. I suppose you want to hit him." Or, "You're jealous of your mother having lovers when you can't get it on with any boy at all." Or, interpretations against the client's family are a particular favorite. Other reductive explanations that supposedly tell why a behavior occurs sound like this. You think no one cares, you feel useless and failed, you think you shouldn't feel what you feel. Again, these examples point out negative structures. They explain by saying what is wrong, or they shoot down the stars. Now, of course, it isn't always that way, but there's a tendency to use interpretation in some way to bring things down. Now, they call it reduction. But there's more to it's not just reduction to a past event, it's to bring things down. There's an even greater poison hidden in the interpretations we give clients. Our accounts tend to be rational, causal, and conceptual. They're on a different wavelength, which creates a static, a jamming static, that breaks into the silence and interrupts imagining. Imagining is a process of significant elaboration. Imagining is a process of significant elaboration. It goes on and on elaborating its own material. As the children elaborate the duck, the house, the girl under the tree, into perhaps something further, a frog pond with an empty car nearby, or a rain cloud coming with lightning in it. It goes on and on elaborating. This activity of significant elaboration channels emotions into images or by means of images. Imagining is not headlong and heedless. It proceeds in definite patterns that are almost stereotypes or cliches. So again and again, the whole world over, and this is the very Jungian point of view towards the imagination, there are basic significances, falling and flying and crossing a stream, building up and tearing down, opposing forces, reconciliations, climates and altitudes, fire and water, body parts, body stuffs, waste areas, dugout shelters, dark forests and seas. In other words, the archetypal imagination of motifs. There are machines and tools and colors and numbers and animals and stars, personages of power, of kindness and teaching, of protection and persecution and cruelty, ogres, giants, wise men, we see them in the movies and so on. These figures and these themes or myth themes appear in folk and fairy tales, in stories, in theme parks, in television, in religious rites, neighborhood games and neighborhood gangs, and in dreams of and drawings by clients. They give patterns of significance to our lives. They are the universals of the imagination, the archetypals. Because we can never get out of the psyche, as Jung said, we can never but be in one or another of these patterns. We're always in a myth theme, one or another. Which means, really, that our lives are significant before we understand them. Our lives are significant, are already significant before we understand them. It's not that understanding makes life significant. It's already significant, which also suggests that the unexamined life is indeed worth it. Before we understand them and before we explain them, we are in significant patterns or archetypal myths. Or better said, our lives become significant the moment we recognize a pattern of imagination going on in the midst of a mess. Each mess is an elaboration of imagining. A mess is indeed all in the mind. So interpretations, explanations, and accounts of what you are doing and why, all the because answers to the question why, mainly translate images into concepts. Huddled under the doorway becomes sheltering. Blood dripping from a pierced finger becomes wounding. A tree with mottled brown bark and wide roots translates into the concept growth. We begin to think about growth, and we use the word growth, and we lose the tree. Its levels and branches and trunk and wide roots, all of which are growing and decaying. The tree, vital with its own beauty and richly elaborating itself, vanishes. We have exchanged that tree for growth. You walk into the therapy room with this tree imagination, this painting that you may have done, this dream you had, this thing you saw. You talk about it, and you walk out of the therapy room, not with the tree anymore, but with the idea of growth. It's been translated. The black snake in the dream from which you try to run becomes your mother problem, or your sexual problem, or your death anxiety. And the snake, which is a snake, becomes a problem. A snake which had to be watched carefully and responded to becomes an anxiety. Now it is a dead snake stuffed with psychological concepts. It's been interpreted. Whatever we say has been used against it. To keep the imagining going on with its life of significant elaboration, these conceptual interpretations need to be silenced. We need to respect the doorway huddle, the dripping blood, the mottled tree trunk, and the black snake as such. They are silent as paintings are silent, as dance is, and as music is. In short, the image is primary, the concept secondary. The image is poetic, the interpretation prosaic. The image is emotionally significant as such. Interpretation recollects the emotion in rationality. The image is intensely vivid. It moves with its own life. It is chilling, fascinating, loathsome, gorgeous, painful, desirable, with a particularized energy, intensely individual. That is, your image alone arriving silently out of the blue. You alone beheld it, and images arise in individuals freely and spontaneously. They have an individualizing effect, almost anarchic, because of their unpredictability. This autonomy or anarchy of the image is the source of personal expression, making each painting, song, and story different. So, on the one hand, because of the archetypal themes of falling and flying and crossing rivers and trees and snakes and stars and colors and numbers, images have a kind of collective similarity, the symbolic aspect. On the other hand, they're intensely individual as images because they're shaped and anarchic. You can never replicate that particular image. So if you look at the image symbolically, you're going to universalize them. If you look at the image imaginatively, you're going to see the particular specialty of this one single thing. This anarchy is the source of the struggle we have when trying to give expression to our private images. Now, the good interpretation, I have been talking about bad ones, so now I have to talk about good ones. The good ones speak to the image in their own language. A good interpretation does not use big, flabby concepts like growth, sexuality, creativity, aggression, and anxiety, or depression, but responds with compact images like the black snake wants to get closer to you, to touch you, talks to the image in the same language that the image talks to you. It doesn't translate it into something else. Does that snake want more body warmth? Huddled under the doorway, what are you wearing? Whose doorway is it? What sort of building? Is there anybody else around? Could you make a little fire there, or is it too windy, or what? These remarks do not ask for answers. They do not explain anything. Instead, they lead into further silent imagining. So you've gone into the image that's there, the doorway, or the blood, or the snake. And you've asked questions, but you're not looking for an answer. You're just looking to move further and elaborate the imagination. The imagination is prompted to go back into itself, to watch and hear and feel and think further. Again, this sensing, feeling, and thinking is intensely individual, an individuality that drowns in the bog of collective words like aggression, anxiety, sexuality, and so forth. Furthermore, these responses appeal to the image itself to be present in the response. These questions appeal to the image to be present in the response. So you're still talking about the doorway and the snake and the blood. We answer from the doorway or in the presence of the snake. When talking with a child, we are by the duck pond. We are in the image and not detached observers. So the counselor, the therapist, the art therapist, whatever it is, the parent is entered the image with the child and is sitting by the duck pond and talking from the same place as the image. You're both in it. So let's return to the motto, whatever you can say, or whatever you say can and will be used against you. Now there's sort of two you's in that sentence. The you who is imagining and the you who is asking questions and explaining. These two yous may be enacted by the two people in the therapy room, but they may also be enacted by each of us alone in our silent dialogues, back and forth with ourselves when exploring our private dreams and fantasies. Because the you who interprets often reduces a dream by explaining the way the power of its images. The dream asks for silence so as to be kept vital and intact. They come in silence, and maybe they are best kept in silence, as when we write the dream down in a dream journal. So this analysis that we just went through poses a dilemma between two different kinds of wrongs, between saying nothing, on the one hand, a kind of Rogerian reflective yes, which often is just a repetitious non-intervention, versus conceptualized snake-killing explanations on the other hand. So to avoid this dilemma, I don't propose literal silence as if all speech were destructive to imagination. Silence doesn't have to mean literal silence. The question is not whether to speak or not to speak. The question is how to speak. What to say, when to utter. The when of intervention, the what theoretical framework you use in interpreting, and the how of technique, the when, the what, the theoretical framework, and the how of technique to assure someone or to coax something or to limit it or to confront it. These are all well-known things that you learn in counseling. I mean, that's what you're supposed to learn. In your training, you have lots about timing and about theories and about technique. But so let me press instead this question of who. The who speaks, that you that speaks, must originate in the same place and speak in the same style as the material spoken to. This inherent correspondence is more than empathy. It's more than a feeling skill. Rather, it is the animal response that gives a human voice to the silence of imagination. It's the voice of a freely imagining agent at home both in the dream and in the arts, which suggests that the arts are crucial for the training of the therapist. And now we come to the second part of what I want to say this evening. So, I linked silence with imagining, and I linked wrong speech with injuring imagination. That we did already. Now I want to show both that imagining is important for human rights, and that the basis of these rights lies in silence. So now we're going to move towards the political part. Silence presupposes an interior life. When activity is stilled, stimuli are shut down and dulled, and the pressures of relatedness are relaxed, imagination germinates more freely, in freedom, suggesting that silence has political implications. Before the right to free speech, free press, free worship, and free elections is the right to remain silent, because this right assumes the free person within who speaks, who prints, who worships, who votes, that individualized who shall not be abused, invaded, or constrained. Rights, according to our political notions, are inalienable. That is, they are lodged in the individualized soul, and freedom, according to these same political notions that we all live under, is exercised by this agent who has something to say or print. There'd be no point in having freedom of speech if there wasn't someone who had something to say, a who wanted to print, or who votes personal choices and considers personal gods. All the other rights require, first of all, an imagining someone who can consider alternatives, improvise actions, express values, and fantasize outcomes. Silence assumes the primacy of a psychic person. The primacy of a psychic person, a soul that has these intentions, choices, things to say, intentions. Inalienable rights are the powers of this inalienable person whose imagining mind has not been alienated. This notion derives from a view of soul which holds, and of course this is not Locke's view of soul, but Plato's view of soul, which holds that the soul comes natively endowed, that there is an individuality from the beginning, this is also Jung's, and that silence is a condition for its flourishing. The fear of silence, therefore, and the fear of silence that occurs in the therapy room or when you are alone in silence, is not so much a fear of emptiness, the fear that should we be still we would fall into the void of nothing to say or show or tell. Quite the contrary. It's the fear of fullness, of the incredible, unpredictable, and freewheeling fantasies that are native to the mind and show themselves so readily in dreams. The fear is of our inwardness, which threatens to be an Aladdin's cave or a primeval forest teeming with wildlife. If silence invites the imagining agent on whom political freedoms depend, then weakening the imagining agent weakens the roots of freedom without attacking the freedoms directly. Did you get that? See, if silence invites the imagining agent on whom political freedoms depend, then any weakening of the imagination weakens the political roots. There's no need to repress freedom of speech or assembly or the right to worship if there's no one at home with something to say or with a need to pray. Freedom implies a someone who can imagine things otherwise. So in the last 10 years, we've had an enormous amount of freedom in one sense, but there's been nobody at home imagining things otherwise. The dangers in our country are not because of repression of the freedoms that are overt and visible, like assembly or press. They're the freedoms that are disappearing through the weakening of the structures of imagination. Totalitarian states submit imagination to doctrine. The individual imagination is harnessed and censored. Under these conditions of duress, silence stands out as a most precious right. It is clung to fanatically and literalizes into paranoid secrecy that resists even torture. The human right to remain silent becomes a sacred obligation, a last-ditch defense of the soul. How else can we understand the incredible witness of silence unto death from Salem in the 17th century in Massachusetts to Siberia, from Christian martyrs to underground radicals? And how else can we understand the reluctance to tell afterward of the horror endured under torture by its victims? Unspeakable, they often say. We can also begin to understand the repression in totalitarian states of the other freedoms, speech, assembly, worship. Sheer freedom, without a responsive imagining agent, runs riot and perverts into chaotic libertinage in a vicious circle of control versus chaos. Freedom imagined as total release remains totalitarian. Freedom imagined as total release, primal scream, wilding, slam dancing, freedom imagined as total release remains totalitarian. This idea of freedom is merely the imagination of a captive or a slave, indicating that the imagination is still captive, still slave to total solutions. The first step out of this totalitarian circle of control or chaos is not the restoration of political freedoms, but the restoration of imagination itself so that it can adequately imagine freedom as located in the inward silence of a concentrated and responsive imagining agent on whom the free exercise of human rights depends. In short, the sort of democracy envisioned by our founding documents and ensured, one hopes, by the Supreme Court derives from a populace of keenly and lively imagining persons. This democracy is not the numerical democracy, so often misrepresented as the egalitarian quantitative measurement of opinions, which reduces to a democracy of the lowest common denominator. Nor is it a democracy of free enterprise, which is actually the misrepresentation of individuality, of imagination, as individualistic exploitation. Neither the excessively egalitarian nor the excessively individualistic view is what's in the founding documents. Rather, they emphasize individualities as the ultimate seat of power, widely differing individualities, an almost anarchic condition of gun-bearing citizens, each of whom is in pursuit of differing happinesses and defends private domains. The differing individual imaginations manifesting themselves as differing religious concerns, geographical loyalties, philosophical commitments, and economic goals must be fundamentally affirmed, not dissolved in the ogre's cauldron called America, the melting pot. The founding documents assume these inalienable differences of imagination in the citizenry, and so the Constitution had to provide means for negotiating differences, executive, legislative, judiciary, and so on. Now, the relationship between silence imagination, and human rights in the American democracy raises familiar questions. Do the arts belong in public schools? Why should there be courses in music appreciation? Why learn an instrument at public expense? Why take trips to museums or have clay and painting studio classes? Why memorize poems or play theater? What of these activities, usually classed as extracurricular, emphasizing their extraneous nature, to do with the earthly ethics of social and economic democracy? Do they in any way make a more informed citizenry, build a better public opinion base regarding the issues of the day? What, indeed, is the value of the arts for social studies and for society? The old answers to these questions said the arts were useful for learning history, or creative expression, fostered personal growth, made a person happier, and thus enriched society. Or these soft snap courses add aesthetic accomplishment, produce a finer finish, which broaden people, making them more useful to the community as players in the band, or public speakers, or managers of children. And of course, the old answers implied that the arts were mainly for women and artistic personalities or misfits. The old answers saw nothing essential in the arts. They were not necessary, merely secondary embellishments, like hobbies or trivial pursuits, that would enable one to identify music on the car radio as Wagner or the columns on the bank portal as Doric. And if not plain snobbery, the arts are certainly irrelevant for the real issues like consumer protection, race relations, and the minimum wage debate. But the answer that emerges from my argument says something quite different. It says that without an exercised imagination, there is an anesthetized stupidity in the public arena, a kind of sense-impaired response to the sensate world. We become insensitive to each other and to our own sensitivities. We will have lost the ability to be aesthetically persuaded. If the citizen cannot be moved by an editorial or a politician's rhetoric or an artist's statement or an architect's construction, has no real effect. The freedom it enunciates assumes that there's an imagining heart in the body politic that responds in action. That sensitivity the Athenians, where democracy first began, called Pytho, the persuasive goddess on whose ability to affect our souls depends free speech, fair trial, free press, and elections. Anesthetized responses. And you know, this word anesthetized is important. Robert J. Lifton says that the problem today, our basic problem today, and this is something we want to talk about tomorrow in the workshop, he says that the basic problem today is psychic numbing. He's saying we're anesthetized. So we don't react to what happens. We don't even sense it. We don't know when we're insulted. So anesthetized responses are not simply unimaginative and insensitive. They have become merely mechanical reactions to stimuli. No response means no responsibility. The anesthetized imagination becomes sociopathic and amoral. Without the enlivened imagination, there's no perception of insult and injury, no sense of injustice, and so no real sense of justice either. We're already in the slave camps of the mind. Without the enlivened imagination, there can be no comprehension of the issues at stake and no basis for ethical judgment or political decision. Why are artists so often involved in social protest and so protective of human rights? Why is their very presence so threatening to the totalitarian state? Why are they never invited to the White House? The reason must lie in their dedication to an imagination trained in silence, having exercised the first freedom, the right to remain silent. They are acute to the basic other human rights. Now, this suggests that rights must be put into action, into practice. As spiritual virtues, they exist in actu, not in potentia. That is, unless we speak out and read and vote and assemble, these virtues are simply abstractions written into the law but not behaved in life. And silence, too, is not passive quiet, but needs to be practiced, whether in solitude or as a moment of internal echoing in the midst of things. The counseling room is a place for this practice, and therapy is as much an education in silence as it is in talking. The ethical shocks now devastating our institutions need to be seen in the light of what we're talking about this evening. The issues are not simply what rules obtain, how to define a conflict of interest or an arm's length transaction, how to distinguish between a tax shelter or a tax evasion, a gift and a bribe, what precisely constitutes plagiarism, adultery, euthanasia, or truth in labeling. The technical precision of ethics merely repeats the same kind of thinking from which comes the disease. And remedies cannot be concocted from a makeup course in ethics at a week. Apart from the moral imagination. For first of all, we must have that feeling that something is amiss, fishy, or compromising. We must be able to imagine wrong and what it might do to the soul. To imagine wrong and what it might do to the soul. Moral imagination is awakened and trained by confrontations with the great moral dilemmas of Abraham and Peter, the Greek tragedies of Hamlet, Macbeth, of Anna Karenina and Madame Bovary, novels by Hawthorne, Dostoevsky, Faulkner, Orwell, Philip Roth. They way surpass the ethical instruction derived from case studies and legal precedents, because the study of great lives and literature opens the imagining heart to moral perplexity rather than just providing rules, conventions, and answers. If we cannot imagine honor, dignity, sacrifice, compassion, courage, loyalty, as well as ugliness of soul and the sins of avarice, how can we make an ethical decision or even recognize that there is one to be made? Besides, there is a morality of craft, the moral imagination of the hands, the ears, and eyes that the arts teach. The arts try to get it right, do it well, an honest job that is truthful to the claim of the work. And that kind of moral language is used again and again with getting it right, doing it over until you get it right, in any of the arts. If this be the case, then the new answer to the old question about the relationship between the arts and social studies would go like this. The arts are not an adjunct. The arts are rather the place where silence is fostered by reading, writing, throwing a pot, practicing the clarinet, or stretching at the bar. These activities in silence, by challenging collective anesthesia, activate the imagining person at the heart of all social and political life. Artistic activities are more than just worthwhile in themselves, because they ground the rest of the curriculum in a truly human agent. This bears upon dyslexia and illiteracy. Why have we as a nation become more and more illiterate? We blame television and the computer, but they're not really causes. They're results of a prior condition that invited them in. They arrive to fill a gap. When imaginative ability declines, other ways to communicate appear. These ways work even though they too are dyslexic in structure. I mean, computer and media, TV. A simultaneity of bits, odd juxtapositions, messages that do not move linearly from left to right. Yet television and personal computers communicate. Evidently, reading doesn't depend solely on the ordering of words or letters, or the letters in the words. Indeed, poets use dyslexic structures deliberately. Reading depends on the psyche's capacity to enter imagination. Reading is more like dreaming, which too goes on in silence. Our illiteracy reflects an educative process away from the silent grounds of reading, away from silent study halls and quiet periods, solitary homework, learning by heart, listening through a whole class without interruptions, writing an essay exam in longhand, drawing from nature instead of lab experiments. This long neglect of imaginational conditions that foster reading, computers and the new math, social problems and social relatedness, me-centered motivation, the confusion of information with knowledge, of opinion with judgment, and trivia with sources. Communication as messages by telephone calls and answering machines rather than as letter writing in silence. Learning to speak up without first having something learned to say. Multiple choice and scoring as a test of comprehension. That's what's produced illiteracy. The human person as a data bank does not need to read more than functionally. A data bank deciding yes or no on the basis of feedback, called reinforcement, need not imagine beyond getting, storing, and spending. Just get the instructions right, never mind the content. Learn the how rather than the what with its qualities, values, and subtleties. The human agent becomes an incarnated credit card, performing the religious rituals of consumerism and telling the beads of little slips for the IRS. You need only be able to sign your name in the space marked X, like an immigrant, like a slave, or a psychopath. Descriptions of psychopathy or sociopathic personalities speak of their inability to imagine the other. Psychopaths are well able to size up situations and charm people. They perceive and assess and relate. That's not the trouble. Make use of any opportunity. Hence their successful manipulations of others. But the psychopath is far less able to imagine the other beyond a fantasy of usefulness. The other is a true interiority with his or her own needs, intentions, and feelings. An education that in any way neglects imagination is an education into psychopathy. It is an education that results in a sociopathic society of manipulations. We learn how to deal with others and become a society of dealers. Neither the media, legal or illegal drugs, the education bureaucracy, nor the absent moral authority of parents are to blame for the ethical vacuum and our stupefaction. These usual scapegoats are the symptoms, and as such are not causes, but the presentation of prior invisible suffering. In fact, symptoms are failed attempts at cure. That's crucial. We know that from Freud on. Symptoms are compromises. They're failed attempts at cure. The turn to crack and cocaine, for example, is partly in search of a higher imagining to awaken the dead. The education bureaucracy arose to bridge the great gaps in imagination between the desire to learn and the desire to teach. Such a simple thing. Everybody wants to teach somebody. So, oh, let me show you how to do that. Oh, can you show me how to do that? How does that go? Say that again. Such a simple thing. I want to learn, I want to teach. But when that all falls apart, we get this giant structure called education between the two. The authority of parenting faded long ago when aesthetic skills and thus sensitive responses were considered inferior to moral rules. Let me read that one again. The authority of parenting faded long ago when aesthetic skills and thus sensitive responses were considered inferior to moral rules. A morality literalized into rules is but a mechanized skeleton following commandments, incognizant of the moral struggle demanded by a life of imagination. So it's not the media that are to blame. Where the media may not report accurately the state of the world, or the emotions of the family, or the piety of faith, the media do indeed report the audience. That television glass in the living room accurately reflects the psyche that sits before it. Television is a mirror showing us our own faces. And so if we must blame, then let's blame ourselves. We counselors or therapists or analysts or whatever we are supposedly the great remedial force. Do we give our clients the right to remain silent, or do we pump them up with more information? Do we assume a soul rich with native endowment within a depressive passivity or recalcitrant learning disorders? Do we think we have to put something into the person? Do we encourage the client's fantasies and dreams with our speaking, or cut them down to the reduced size of our theories? Do we recognize the inherent necessity of imagining in the human person as the guarantor of the person's freedom and the vitality of our political system? Do we stand authoritatively and administratively, filling out forms? Or can we stand subversively, as did Freud and Jung and Adler and Reich and Socrates and Jesus too? Those therapeutic educators are the founding figures of the helping profession, standing subversively against the state of the society when it is unethical, sociopathic, unimaginative. Or do we persuade adaptation to that society as we help our clients to cope, get along, relate? Relate to what? Don't we ask them to adapt to a non-imaginal world at the cost of the silent, imagining animal agent on whom the world's very life depends? All right, I'll end with a final flourish of rhetorical politics. counselors are the actual freedom fighters. We are freedom fighters not only because of our outrage over race discrimination and oppressions of sex, over corporate exploitation and consumerism's poverty, over child spoiling and child neglect, drug corruption, callous pollution, abortion absurdity, textbook destructions, military machismo, bureaucracy, pettifoggery of the bureaucrats and insurance companies, and textbook destructions and fundamentalist deceit and fundraising hypocrisy, to say nothing of the staggering gamut of client tragedies that counselors must face every day. We are freedom fighters because we are the advanced guard of imagination as it tries to break into our civilization by touching its citizens through the symptoms of its discontents. And we are the advanced guard because we, like the artists, are the ones authorized to meet the symptoms by imaginal means. We've been given the tools of imaginative language, of art therapy, sand play, drama, dance, play, and rooms for conversation and silence. Moreover, unlike the artists, we've been given a special authority to use these imagining tools with the civilization's victims, the symptomatically disenfranchised who are our clients. I would remind you especially of the disenfranchised children who carry so much of our civilization's disordered imagination, too conveniently, too rationally called adjustment disorders. Victims of another attrition and another hunger, the systematic anesthesia of imagination in the name of development and achievement. The push forward, starting ever earlier, has kept them out of the halls of fantasy, depriving them of that great gift with which each child comes endowed, the wonder of silence. Through them, and our work with them in silence, exile, and cunning, as Joyce said, the small beginnings of the freely imagining agent may subversively re-enter the community and stealthily infiltrate the body politic. That civilization may not sink, its great battle lost, quiet the dog, tether the pony, as Yeats wrote in the same poem which has as its chorus, like a long-legged fly upon the stream, the mind moves upon silence. Thank you. I don't think I would make a big difference. Must repeat the question. Would I speak about psychotic experience and how it relates to silence? Unless we're talking about a particular insistence on silence, a catatonic silence or something that goes on for a long time, I don't think I would make a big distinction. You have something special in mind? See, I think that if we can imagine that something is going on in the silence, that the soul comes natively endowed, then the attitude towards the silence of the therapist will be a little different from simply wanting that person to start making sounds, noise, talk, as if that were the improvement. Quite possibly, it would be an attitude in my mind about what that space of silence is in which something's taking place. I would be imagining the soul is natively endowed. And so there would be ways of being in a mimetic relationship either with my body and that person's body in the silence. So I would be silent too, mirroring, or there'd be a place for drawing or dancing or moving or something which would respect and allow the silence and not insist that it move into its opposite, which is talk. Go ahead. Do I think the different forms of psychotic experience would be different forms of imagining silence? Did I get that right?
Yes.
Well, that's a nice way of imagining it. Yes, why not? I hadn't thought that, but why not?
Is that published, what you read from?
Is that published? Yes, it is. It's. I've adapted it a little bit, but it is published. I can. You want to know? You want. It's in what?
Like the title of the journal.
Oh, it's a very odd journal. It's called the Journal of Humanistic Education and Development. It's the basic journal of the people in what's called in counseling and development. It's the American Association of Counseling and Development journal. But I haven't read that I read that too as a keynote address to counseling art therapy section. It was a section called American Association of Counseling and Development, a section called The Creative Arts and Human Rights in Counseling. But this is the first time I've read it to anybody else. But it was printed. What? Oh, the date. Volume 26, number 4. Volume 26, number 4, June 1988. The Journal of Humanistic Education and Development. And the title of the article is the title of what we had here this evening called The Right to Remain Silent. Towards symptom relief is therapy directed towards accommodation.
To some sort of existing rate of order in that sense.
Yes. Getting somebody to adapt to a system rather than to imagine the symptom as subversive.
Right.
Since the symptom is subversive to adaption, if one goes from a Jungian point of view towards the symptom and let the symptom be the teacher of the ego rather than the ego try to bring the symptom under control, so to speak, then you would get a whole different vision. If you read the works of John Perry, The Far Side of Madness. He's a Jungian psychiatrist in San Francisco who did that dialysis, right. Worked with young, first-time acute schizophrenic people, showing the reordering of the world that is going on in the imagery of this breakdown. So, see, that's what I meant when I said relate to what. Now, what I'm doing there is I'm sound as if I'm siding with the psychiatry of the 60s, Cooper and Lang and so on. You know, if the society is out of order, then those who are disturbed are the ones who are probably in order. That was their view. But that was a tremendous simplistic. And I'm not trying to do that, but what your question raises does move a little bit in that direction. All I want to do is have more respect for the symptom, which is strict Jungian way of looking at it. Jung's point was, what's the symptom disturbing? What's its purpose within the body politic? The body politic being the human, the person's behavior patterns and lifestyle and so on.
It just seems to me that compassion, so far as relief from suffering, which the symptoms are part of, sometimes seems difficult to be addressing that issue and also the issue of the...
You mean compassion as relief from symptom?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a biggie, isn't it? Is that what compassion is, relief from symptom? See, if we get like that, we get into, I don't have time for the pain.
I don't think the word compassion
means relief.
I think it means to suffer
with
someone
else. So, I don't think the question, I have to say these things again. Compassion doesn't mean relief from pain, it means suffering with, is what you just said, yes? Okay, thank you. Yes?
What would you see as the role of introversion and extroversion in this?
What is the role of introversion and extroversion in this? I don't think it has a role in this. I think whether you're introverted or extroverted, there are parts of you who are both anyway. We're never one thing. I mean, as soon as I move this way with my extroversion, somebody else is going to back in the other room. We're not one person. That's to begin with. And then secondly, it would be a cop-out to imagine introverts don't vote. You don't mean that, surely.
Oh.
Oh, I see. That it, within the individual person, it's the introverted part of ourselves that goes into the silence. I think that's an important question, because the way I understand the silence and the introversion is that it isn't being literally introverted by going into a room and closing the door on the world. It's the way you listen, the way you are in the world that has a silence in it, so that there's resonance and echo and looking again and arrestation of movement. And that can be both introvert, that's carrying a kind of soul with you everywhere, soul as receptivity, rather than a behaved pattern of life, which is, I'm going home an introvert. Do you see? Or I'm going to a party an extrovert. That it isn't that. Please.
Is that like the cat watching?
It's like the cat watching. The cat's completely there. But it's also something, there's something else happening too. Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the animal part to it. Because you wouldn't call an animal an introvert or an extrovert, you know? We wouldn't. I mean, we could if we wanted to play the game, you know, but I don't think... I think the difficulty is that we've got those labels imagined in a very narrow form of behavior. That extrovert goes out, introvert goes in, and that's sort of it. And that we discover soul through introversion, which leaves the world out there without soul. Yeah, please. How would you relate the disappearance, the extinction of animal species to the anesthetized imagination? I think you just did it. it's been a long process of not caring, but there's something, some kind of sensitivity reoccurring now. But there's still a psychic numbing regarding ourselves, that we are perhaps the endangered species. The tie between us all is still difficult for us to realize. There's a lot more sensitivity to that now, I believe. Still probably not enough. Please.
Do you make a distinction between soul and spirit?
You bet. Do I make a distinction between soul and spirit? And what was the second part? I'd rather say you bet than describe it. I'd rather refer to something to read, because it's something I've been doing for 20 years, and it's awfully difficult to put into a few words. And by putting it in a few words, I tend to take the side of spirit, because then you're using spiritual definitions, logical separations, and so on. But if we use the language of images, then soul tends to be the valleys, and spirit the peaks. Soul tends to
be moist, spirit tends to be dry. Spirit tends to be abstract, soul tends to be concrete. Soul tends to be messy, spirit loves things clear. The difference between yesterday, seeing the mountains 60 miles away, and 2 weeks of gray rain, there's a great deal more. Soul tends to be communal, spirit tends to be isolated. Spirit tends to speak in very powerful words like truth, one, and soul tends to talk more of the language of the heart. Soul's full of seductions and temptations and messes. So psychotherapy is involved very much with the world, realm of soul. And spirit tends to want to get rid of the images and the confusions and temptations, so it's involved with meditation and Buddhism and things like that. Discipline. Logic. Those are
abbreviations. Yes, please. That was tiring trying to do that.
Yes, that's more soul getting tired when you're... When spirit doesn't get tired. Doesn't have symptoms. Isn't that right? Yeah, go ahead.
I'm saying that if you understand me, then... am I saying that imagination is a property of the soul?
I don't know. I wouldn't try to define it. I guess I've connected it with soul, yes. What I've been finding in the therapeutic community is that it's very hard to bring a body in.
Yeah, and so one thing is just the fact that you can see that the body is difficult, it seems to make sense to me in terms of what you're talking about, that if there's a way that it's difficult for us to be in the room with the imagination, to get to the imagination, and it would also be difficult for us to be in the body.
If it's difficult to be
with imagination, and it will also be difficult to move with our clients. Is that what you say?
Yeah.
Body movement.
Mm-hmm. It's like culturally.
Well, against realizing that the body is the locus of soul, and the expression of soul and the experience of soul and so on. Well, isn't your question about the relation to the body very similar to your question about the relation to the animal and the psychic anesthesia? That with the extinction of the animal species, there's also a kind of extinction. How much body do you need to work your laptop? What? You need a lap.
And the first thing you have to do is get those goddamn kids off your lap.
Yes, please.
You made some comments about some of the problems with education.
I made comments about some of the problems of education. Yes, I did.
Pardon? Yes.
How do we go about reintroducing silence into education?
Given that we have to work with this, somebody,
a lot would have to do with the conception of the human being to begin with. And if the human being is empty in our tabula rasa idea, that it's not innately endowed, it's not in Aladdin's cave, as I suggested. That the human being, the soul, is in Aladdin's cave. If we don't have a Jungian view, I have to make a plug here. If we don't have a Jungian view of the soul as natively endowed, as archetypally gifted, then we've got to start very early pumping stuff into the child. So it's not just what are the techniques to use, it's the question of the very vision of what is a human person, what is a soul. Or do we even use the word soul in regard to a person in education, or is soul left only for church? I mean, is soul used in school anywhere? So it's not so much, I think, what to do as those kinds of values need to be reintroduced in our own thinking. And I think many teachers feel that, especially teachers of very young children. They feel that. I mean, they feel the soul in the child. But then they have a set of standards that they have to meet. They have to get that child to a certain place where it can pass certain that the child is loaded with a certain amount of information so it can go to the next level. Oh, a lot of questions. Because one little tiny thing I've been thinking about, what would it be if the sound part of the TV broke and didn't forbid the kid watching TV, but let them watch without any talk, without any sound? And what imagination would go on then with the images, whether they're cartoons or whatever they are, so that they would do their own imagining?
I've done it on purpose. It's very calming.
Very calming. Woody Allen has done that.
What's up, Tiger?
Uh-huh. What's up, Tiger? What's up, Tiger Lily? Woody Allen did that, where there's a kind of a silent movie of
what he did was he took all the sound out and then imagined and put it in his own.
Did you get that on your? It didn't work as a movie, but it did a lot for his soul. It's also the case, if you look at the animal shows on television. If you just look at the animal shows and you turn off the commentaries, because the commentaries are presenting American capitalist mythology. All these animals are defending their territory. The males are all trying to, clash with each other in order to get the females. Predators. You've got to watch out for predators all the time. The whole world is set up. There's sort of a. But if you get rid of the various myths that go with the animal images and just watch the animal images, you get another feeling about what's going on out there. But those are, I don't have many practical ideas. Yes, please.
On the analysis room, do you have any ideas on how we can bring this idea? I was taught this idea of being responsible citizens, which has remained very abstract. Do you have any ideas about how to make that a more livable?
How to be a responsible citizen? You were raised with that idea, but how do you make it a more livable?
Rather than so abstract, and it's still very abstract.
It's not abstract at all. It starts with a very simple thing called outrage. Number one, outrage. Second of all, trusting what's called empty protest. See, one of the ways they stop protest is to tell you, well, have you got a better idea? Well, what would you do? Christ, I don't know what I would do. It doesn't matter. I have no idea what I would do, but I know what you're doing is wrong. And that's just straight, that's an empty protest. No, that's not an empty protest. Protest starts with the recognition of being insulted, being in outrage. This won't work, whatever it is. I don't like it. I have no idea how to do it, because I'm not a reformer, I'm not a planner, I've got no ideas of how to organize any of it. But this, I won't do this. See, the idea that they catch you by telling you, well, if you're so smart, then what would you do? I don't know what I'd do, but I know I would. And that's an American thing, you know, to protest. Countries founded on Protestantism, you know, protesting. Getting away from Europe and protesting. Well, we're almost at the end, are we not? Well, tell me. What? Okay, well, yes, please.
You brought up torture victims and then what their feelings
are unspeakable. And their defense of silence.
You work with people for whom silence is sometimes unbearable as they're drawing or working or sitting with you. Or they can't
even start it.
They can't even start
the drawing or writing. Or quiet.
They can't be quiet alone. Mm-hmm. And so your question was?
Tell me what to do.
It's long and slow. It's long and slow, but it's also having an interest in the imagery. Being in a strange way much more interested in the imagery than in the feelings. More interested in what the psyche's doing and loving what the psyche does than in compassion for the person suffering. Because that ties you up in a place where you too then become cautious, worried. You begin to develop the same kind of anxiety towards the material rather than realizing the psyche is not out to get you.
That's a good place to stop. I think that's a good place to stop. Thank you.